Can you hear me okay? My name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm publisher of The Atlantic. I wanted to welcome you and thank you for joining The Atlantic for its Day of Ideas here in New York. In case you've missed it, we are celebrating a big anniversary, our 150th, and we're doing it with a national tour going to five cities and celebrating the ideas that have made The Atlantic across this century and a half. We started in Boston, where the magazine was founded, then went to Washington, which is now our home base, went to Chicago, to San Francisco, and now finishing here in New York, the center of the universe for media, publishing, literature, and great thought. I probably don't need to tell you that.
Yeah.
Across this tour, we will host and entertain and engage almost 5,000 of our readers. And our hope is, in doing so, to bring to life the themes and the issues and the voices that have made The Atlantic what it is for this century and a half. Our tradition was started in the library of the Parker House Hotel in Boston in the mid-1800s, when a group of esteemed thinkers and writers gathered there and determined that young America needed a great and original magazine to capture and to chronicle the American idea. The group that gathered at that time was Ralph Waldo Emerson, James Russell Lowell, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And the backdrop to the start of The Atlantic was a time of great national strife over slavery and a growing abolition movement. And The Atlantic stepped into that fray and offered a platform for abolitionist views and a national organ in support of presidential candidate Abraham Lincoln. The Atlantic's history included, in fact, reporting from the Civil War by Nathaniel Hawthorne and the original publication of the Battle Hymn of the Republic by Julia Ward Howe. Our great tradition of covering national and global dynamics continues today with Atlantic writers such as Robert Kaplan, Mark Bowden, Jim Fallows, reporting from Asia, the Middle East, and all corners of the world. And today we have the pleasure of having Robert Kaplan with us, among others, as we contemplate the world in 2050, China the superpower, ? Not sure we need the question mark. And in fact, Robert wrote a cover story for The Atlantic last year, How We Would Fight China. And he noted in that story, the Middle East is just a blip. The American military contest with China in the Pacific will define the 21st century. And China will be a more formidable adversary than Russia ever was. Our series on the world in 2050 is being sponsored around the country, appropriately enough, by global company British Airways. BA has been a partner to The Atlantic for many years, advertising in our pages and helping us to host these gatherings with our authors and our readers. And British Airways is celebrating its own special moment this month with the launch of its new flatbed and its Club World business class. I hope you'll have an opportunity to experience that.
Not me.
Well, we offer big thanks to British Airways for sponsoring the ideas tour in this particular session. Our conversation today will be led by Atlantic editor James Bennett. James joined us just this spring after 15 years with the New York Times. He went up through the ranks there, Metro reporter, Detroit bureau, White House correspondent during the Clinton administration, and he was Jerusalem bureau chief, had returned from Jerusalem, and was just studying for and en route to China for a posting as Beijing bureau chief when we found him and brought him to The Atlantic instead. He's a Washington native and a Yale graduate, and is a friend and colleague now, so happy to be working with him. This session will run till 11. I'd invite you then to stay on for the next session, which will be on U.S. competitiveness in the global market. It'll be in this room, so stay on with us if you'd like, whether you have tickets or not, and we'll host a light lunch here immediately following that 11 a.m. session. Thanks very much, and I'll turn things over to James.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming. In one of his books, The Gate of Heavenly Peace, our panelist Jonathan Spence of Yale quotes a lecture from the Chinese writer Lu Xun. Someone here will correct my pronunciation. From, thank you. 1923 reads as follows. Unfortunately, China is too hard to change. Just moving a table or repairing a stove tends to involve bloodshed. And even after the blood has flowed, there is no certainty that the change will be made. Unless a great whip lashes her on the back, China will never be willing to move forward of her own accord. Of course, the story we all hear from China today is all about change, economically and socially. Much of it exciting, much of it also unsettling. It, the change has been coming for a long time, but it seems to be moving forward now with a kind of whiplash-inducing speed, propelling China towards great power status economically, culturally, militarily, and diplomatically. We feel the effects of it every day in our lives as we go shopping, of course, and in conversation with businessmen worrying if it's too late for them to get in, and industrial manufacturing and service workers wondering if they're being outsourced out of a job, and parents wondering if it's time to start having their children study Mandarin. And also, of course, policymakers and analysts who are wondering, as we make this transition to a multipolar or bipolar world, whether China will emerge as a stable ally, an unpredictable actor, or even an adversary as it competes more and more for resources, as we try to manage problems from Darfur to Iran, from environmental degradation to nuclear proliferation. We're very lucky to have this group of panelists with us this morning. We have a political scientist, two historians, and a journalist who is something of both. Taking them in alphabetical order, beginning with the journalist, Robert Kaplan is national correspondent for the Atlantic, really international correspondent for the Atlantic. He is now, and I want to get the title right, Bob, the class of 1960 distinguished visiting professor in national security at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis. Bob's reported from 100 countries and is now at work on his 12th book. As Elizabeth mentioned, he wrote a cover story last year for us on how the U.S. military regards China's rise, and in October wrote our cover story on what the demise of the North Korean regime could mean for China and the U.S. and how it might reshape the balance of power in Asia. Moving on in alphabetical order, Min Xin Pei is a Harvard-trained political scientist, senior associate and director of the China program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. His main interests are U.S.-China relations, the development of democratic political systems in Chinese politics. He's the author of numerous articles and op-eds in the New York Times and elsewhere, and several books, including From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union, and China's Trapped Transition, The Limits of Developmental Autocracy. Now to the historians. Jonathan Spence is Sterling Professor of History at Yale. He teaches Chinese history from about 1600 to the present and also tracks the Western images of China since the Middle Ages. He's also, for my money, one of our great writers of narrative nonfiction. His books include The Death of Woman Wang, The Memory Palace of Matteo Ricci, The Gate of Heavenly Peace, which I already referred to, and God's Chinese Son. He's also author of a compact and sharply detailed biography of Mao for the Penguin Lives series. Lastly, Arthur Waldron, Lauder Professor of International Relations at the University of Pennsylvania. He specializes in war strategy, foreign policy, and Asian. Everybody does these days.
That's fine.
Before teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, he was Professor of Strategy and Policy at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and serves on the Board of Directors for Freedom House and is Vice President of the International Assessment and Strategy Center for Asia and Strategy Programs. He's a frequent advisor in Washington on China policy, and he was part of the China Futures Panel, convened by congressional Republicans in 2000 to consider, is it fair to say, whether there was a tilt towards China within the CIA?
Well, wait, now that isn't quite right. That was the Tlaib Commission. It was a nonpartisan panel. It was mandated by Congress, but its task was to investigate whether the CIA was doing a good job on...
I stand corrected.
No, it's important, though, to get this right on China. One of my best students, who's a professor at Davidson, is very much on the left, was a member of this panel, and we were cleared to spend a month running around. Now, of course, our report is absolutely so secret that even the president can't read it. But I'll just say two things, that Bill Gertz of the Washington Times published a little piece saying that we had been very, very hard indeed on what they refer to as the China shop. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'll say is that I have not been at all surprised by the ghastly intelligence failures that have characterized our role in the Middle East. Not surprised at all.
Stand corrected again.
Okay. Well, no, I just want to be sure that it's understood, because it's quite important, actually.
I'd like to start with a question about the ideological underpinnings of China today. What is it that holds this country together? We hear so much about the contradictions within China, the heightening contradictions. And Professor Spence, I thought I'd start with you on this. In your Mao biography, you write, working off notes from a speech Mao gave in 57, though the logic of class war would suggest that the Chinese national bourgeoisie would also be the enemy of the Chinese working class, that was not, in fact, so. Quoting Mao, you say, antagonistic contradictions, if properly handled, can become unantagonistic. Care was needed in defining enemies. These contradictions are, of course, if anything, more antagonistic today. So what do you see as the glue?
Well, I think the glue is moderately frail. I mean, I think that I'm always absorbed by the success China seems to be having in coping with so many extraordinarily complicated problems. And I'm not convinced that the states can or should do terribly much about it. Arthur, I know, has stronger views on this.
Well, no, actually, but I agree with that.
We shouldn't. I think watching and thinking about North Korea, for instance, should tell us that China has very specific frontiers that we don't necessarily understand at all well. And what Arthur said about intelligence failure makes that all the more depressing. But obviously, the key borders historically that China faces and have bred different kinds of tension at different times would be North Korea, or Korea as it was, now split. Absolutely Japan, I would say, and I'm always baffled when Japan keeps being left out of the equation. There was Lu Xun's whip hitting the Chinese forward. It was absolutely Japan in the first half of the 20th century. Adding Russia, adding the Central Asian republics, all of them on the bordering on China, including Tibet, however you wish to interpret its exact international status. And of course, Myanmar and Vietnam. So I've always tried to have a very different look at China, and the state seems to me quite secondary in a way to that. The specific economic tensions now are going to be based on engineering skill and cost efficiency and so on. So China's internal protection is also gaining, as far as I can see, internal protection between provinces and economic hostility between provinces. China has a mass of contradictions right now, and the new government, or the new-ish regime, is handling this at the moment at what I suppose we'd call the engineers level. They're working on infrastructure of all kinds, production of all kinds. The world has changed dramatically, of course, since Mao's time. But I was asked to do a short piece in Time Asia, had a new sort of issue on world leaders, and I was asked to do Deng Xiaoping. And I'm not sure that I should have accepted, but I did, and I wrote it. But I spent about a third of that piece saying Deng Xiaoping cannot be understood without Mao. You know, he's not just suddenly there modernizing something out of nothing. He's deeply implicated and involved in the past battles within the party. And I noticed in the front page story of the Times business section today, I thought an excellent story about the automobile industry in China. Mm-hmm. Really, really well written. I recommend that to people. And I was very startled by the piece of information they gave me there, that the most productive workers in China's new state-of-the-art kind of automobile factories are urged and indeed told to display small party flags on their workstations wherever they happen to be scattered through the plant. So the party is trying to insinuate itself on the shop floor of the new progressive industries, just as it's trying to modernize the party leadership. So in that sense, we've moved into another era. But we're trapped in the Chinese are in many ways caught up in that revolutionary past, I think.
To picking up on one element of that, Dr. Pei, the central government is obviously one of the things that's holding it together. And you've written that this government has shown a fair amount of tactical agility. Yes. but also that there's sort of a frailty among the elites. And I wonder if you could...
First, let me just comment on why there's such complexity, because there are three strands of ideas that hold this country together. First, there's the ideology of power that holds the regime together, because the regime is firmly convinced that it must defend its political monopoly at all costs. Mm. And to that extent, it is willing to adjust its tactics. Second, there is the ideology of money, because the whole entire nation is caught up in the dream of economic modernization. And of course, money gives people hope. And then there's this idea of Chinese nationalism. Many Chinese people believe that today their time in the sun has arrived. So that, I think, these three ideas may have some staying power. In terms of the country at large, you do see the Chinese Communist Party having learned many lessons from the collapse of the former Soviet Union, is doing things that some of us believe are quite smart. But the real question is, if the strategy is fundamentally flawed, because the strategy is to use whatever means available to defend an undemocratic system, regardless of all the challenges that would make such defense ultimately futile, you've got to question whether these tactics will succeed.
I'd like to pick up on the third element that you raised there, Chinese nationalism, and bear down a little bit on the question of what that means and how much it's grounded in what Mao said, a need for some sort of external enemy to give it force. Professor Waldron, do you want to take that one off?
Well, I think that your point is quite right. If you want to understand why China is adopts what often seems to me to be rather self-defeating foreign policy approaches. For instance, nothing could be more foolish than to take a Japan, which has embraced pacifism, has kept its military budget low, has forsworn nuclear weapons and so forth, and then sort of keep poking them in the eye until now it seems that Japan is waking up. Now, to some extent, that's the fault of the North Koreans. As my friend Ambassador Lilly is fond of saying, the Koreans are very good at raining on China's parade. And they did that in 1950 with the Korean War, which of course led to a breakdown of relations between the United States and China for 25 years. That relationship might otherwise have been quite different. And by firing the Taepudong missile over Japan, they woke up the Japanese. I guess the best I can do is say that I think that the George Kennan's great article on the sources of Soviet behavior from Foreign Affairs in the autumn of 1947, much of what it says about the structure of the regime is also applicable to China. It's applicable. I mean, we saw General Galtieri attack the Falkland Islands, and I think again that was an attempt to hold up his own power. This is not something unusual. I would like to make one point, though, about the question you began with about the glue. I woke up this morning in the incredible luxury of the Yale Club, and oddly enough, the first thought that came into my mind as I considered my labors this morning was of Jonathan's, I believe it's your first book. Is it called To Change China?
Yes,
second book. Second book. I mean, with him, you know, we get into triple digits. But the point of the book is really very good, which is that there's not a heck of a lot that outsiders can do, although I would say there are certain things that we can do. But we must not fantasize that somehow we are going to kind of lead China or something like that. But on the question of party rule and the glue, it seems to me that the glue is rather fragile. And the World Journal, which is the largest circulation Chinese paper, I picked up the Saturday copy this morning, And one of the articles it had was about the distribution of Chinese communist documents and newspapers. And they're very concerned that ordinary people read communist magazines and newspapers instead of reading these tabloids and movie magazines and everything, which, as in every other country of the world, have driven the so-called quality, or in this case, the party press, out of existence. And long ago, and I thought this was going to be futile, in Taiwan, the Zhongyang Erba, the central daily news, the party paper, that's now closed down because nobody bought it. Mm-hmm. And the circulation of the People's Daily in China, the paid circulation, is very small indeed. Long ago, I was in Hong Kong, and I came bouncing out of my hotel in the early, and I went down and I said to this nice Cantonese lady, "Do you have the People's Daily?" She had all these papers. And she looked at me as if, as they say in Chinese, she had seen a ghost. And she said, "You know, no one wants to buy that. If you have to get that, go somewhere else." And when I visit my sister-in-law, like all of us, I have a wife from China, from Peking. No, really, that's one of the advantages of learning Chinese. When I visit my sister-in-law, who's a classical musician, and stay at her house outside the Fourth Ring Road in a sort of very, very low low rent. I mean, it's not a place where you find many foreigners. I go out to the newsstands there, and you cannot get the party papers. They're simply not for sale. So that's the first thing. The second thing I'd like to say is something rather historical. I was thinking about Chinese dynasties. And this fits in a little bit with what Jonathan was saying about how you cannot understand what's going on today, or you cannot understand Deng without reference to Mao. It seems to me that the dynasties, think of the Ming dynasty, the Qing dynasty, and then think of communism as a dynasty. They're very, very good at the beginning. But as that quote from Lu Xun suggests, they have great difficulty adjusting. And if you look at the Ming dynasty, which is 1368 to 1644, you'll find that at the beginning they were very, very well organized. But two problems brought them down. One was urbanization, which they had not expected. And the other was their inability to manage relations with the Mongols. And they got themselves stuck to a kind of tar baby of warfare that was completely unnecessary. The Qing dynasty came in as a mighty military power, but it proved unequal to the challenges of sort of 19th century style industrialization, education, and so forth. Well, we think of the PRC. Now it's modernizing madly. But what's really the most modern? What's the most transformative of all of these new technologies? I would argue that it's the internet. And it's the internet that is destroying the print media. It's the internet that is changing the way people relate to each other across national. I mean, the internet is having incredibly powerful effects. How is the PRC reacting to the internet? Well, the answer is they're spending billions and billions of dollars trying to control it. 40,000 people monitoring conversations. They've got only three portals. Cisco and others have sold them the most advanced internet sniffing equipment and so forth. Well, it seems to me that this is an exercise in futility. And if you're going to be modern, you have to embrace the internet. And if your structure of authority and power cannot accommodate the internet, then sooner or later, there's going to have to be a new structure. Thank you.
And Bob, you'll accuse me of putting too much weight here on ideology, probably, but isn't this where the parallel to the Soviet Union breaks down a little bit? If you have this nation that is so preoccupied with making money, where it's trying to assert communist ideology, but nobody takes it seriously, we've got casinos on Macau making $1 million an hour in this communist state. You've drawn the parallel, as has Professor Waldron, to the Soviet Union. Why do you think it has such force?
Well,
let me rephrase the question in a more meaningful way, actually. I'm sorry. Where's the expansionist element in this? Where's the actual threatening element that's left here if it's so preoccupied with its own internal contradictions?
What I see is, unlike everyone here, I cover the Chinese military and the U.S. military adjustment to it. And what I see is that the party is trying to change from being a traditional communist party into just a traditional authoritarian structure that is trying to, it's almost Burkean, trying to slow down change when it's too fast and therefore not follow the Soviet model, where everything fell into chaos. It went from authoritarianism to cold turkey democracy in the 90s in Russia, and you had chaos, upsurge in crime rates, and the Chinese leadership is trying to kind of level that out over a longer period of time. And at the same time, what I think one of the most dynamic things that I see is the military expansion. Double digits relative to GDP, and GDP rising by close to double digits. And the Chinese, unlike the Soviet Union, are buying smart and they're training smart. They're not buying across the board. They're specializing in submarines, diesel, electric, and nuclear. They're putting fiber optic systems underground to have more long-range missiles in Asia that can hit moving targets at sea. And they're doing something the Soviet Union and never did. The Chinese understand that a good military has a good non-commissioned officer corps, meaning sergeants, corporals, or petty officers if it's the Navy, that officers give orders, but it's NCOs that get things done. And the Chinese, unlike the other communist militaries of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, are putting emphasis on NCO training. It's interesting how the U.S. military sees China. The U.S. military responds to capabilities, not intentions, because it doesn't know what Chinese intentions may be 10 years down the road. You know, because who knows what kind of domestic crises there may be in China that will change intentions. And what it sees is a traditional, legitimate rising power, obsessed with energy concerns, that needs to guard sea lanes, that won't trust the U.S. or Indian navies to do it because of its own past, and is very much like the United States after the Civil War, where our economy started churning. It is starting in the late Grant administration up through World War I. And as a result, we suddenly had marine landings throughout the Pacific. We acquired the Hawaiian Islands from the British. The Marines and Navy became active in the northern half of South America. Basically, because our economy was churning so much, we suddenly had interests outside that we never had before. And the Chinese are discovering the same thing. And therefore, to me, one of the big dramas that's coming is that the U.S. Navy is understanding that the Pacific Ocean will no longer be its private lake, and it will have to accommodate not just the rise of Chinese power, but of Indian naval power and others as well.
Could I just make a quick comment? I basically agree with what Robert Kaplan has said about the military. There's no question that the Chinese are building a military very, very rapidly, and I would add that it's one that's very clearly targeted at us. It's fairly, very, very clearly targeted at our carrier battle groups. Now, we could have a long discussion of whether there's going to be some sort of countervailing force emerge. I suspect that, as with the Anglo-German naval race, that all you end up doing is getting a balance, but at a much higher, more costly and dangerous level. But Robert did say that the Soviet Union had collapsed into chaos, and I think this is a point where I would take a little issue. I think Gorbachev, unlike the Chinese leaders, was a rather sincere socialist. He was deeply affected by the Prague Spring. He believed that, in fact, one could make Russia into a sort of beacon of a different kind of system. Now, it turned out that once you take the lid off free expression and so forth, you don't just get people saying, well, we could improve this, we could improve that. You get people saying, look, you really have to change the whole thing. We have to vote and all the rest. And it became, I mean, it's very interesting that in the Soviet Union, Gorbachev believed there's something called Soglasia, which is a kind of a consensus. And we have now this idea of the harmonious, the Hulishia society in China. They're really the same idea. The difference is that in the Soviet Union, Gorbachev, because he actually believed in socialism as an ideal, took the lid off. Now, it didn't work. Chaos developed. But it wasn't bloody. Gorbachev was not a man with a stomach to kill large numbers of people. He killed some. But then he was just too civilized. So the key thing was in 1991 when the Soviet Constitution was revised to permit multi-party system, free speech, elections, and so forth. And I think that Gorbachev really deserves some gratitude for this. Admittedly, he was forced to do this, but he did it. And by doing this, he created a bridge for the Soviet people. It was a bridge that, to be sure, it led them out of communism into the unknown since the first years of the last century, the unknown terrain of democracy and freedom. But on the other hand, remember, all of those KGB internal security units, all of the PLA, mm-hmm. just talking to somebody yesterday, the commander of the nuclear forces in Tartu in Estonia, they told their forces, stay in barracks while the political change goes on, just let it happen. So there was no bloodbath in the Soviet Union. And I think there was
in the Caucasus.
That I agree, but I think that the main point, I think if we think about this, it is astonishing that there was not a much, you're quite right, but it is astonishing that there was, I mean, can you think what would have happened if they had actually sent these KGB units, the People's Armed Police, out to start shooting the Russians?
Well, let me pick up on the example of Gorbachev. Dr. Pitt, do you see, is there a Gorbachev on the horizon within this, and is this regime capable of producing one? And then, more fundamentally, should we be trying to strengthen this regime and guide it, or should we be trying to undermine it?
First of all, I would say, one of the things China has learned from the collapse of the former Soviet Union is to try to prevent another Gorbachev from rising through some ranks. So if you look at the people who are waiting to take over, I think they've been quite successful in eliminating any possibilities. But Gorbachev is a product of his times. I think Gorbachev is a product of the stagnation of the former Soviet Union starting in the late 60s. So it's a, the Soviet Union had to change by the time. So I would say that consciously the Chinese government has succeeded in preventing another Gorbachev from emerging in China. But if the Chinese economy stalls and if political stagnation continues 20 years from now, nearly willing China will have its own Gorbachev. The other question is whether we should strengthen or undermine the regime. I think we should do neither. I think because you cannot, it's against our moral value to strengthen an undemocratic regime. And probably we cannot do a lot. The regime does a pretty good job strengthening itself. You go to China and you check into a hotel. For those of you who've been to China many times, 10 years ago, they'll copy down your passport number, then phone the security bureau. It would probably take 3 to 4 days before the police knows that you are in town. Now they just scan, and they automatically shows up, and they know you are in town within a few hours. And they've been investing a great deal of money into their police monitoring capability. So they're doing a good job strengthening themselves, so we don't have to worry about that. As for undermining the regime, it's very hard to do, especially in a direct way. What we can do is not to give it the international respect it does not deserve. I mean, what bothers me is that throughout the world, you see Chinese leaders are being courted as heroes, as very respectable leaders on the international stage. China is an important country, and we ought to give the country its due. It has done great things in the last 30 years in terms of eliminating massive poverty. It has become a more responsible global power. But we have to benchmark China's progress against its neighbors, against other major countries, and then accord the country's leaders the degree of respect that we think is appropriate to those benchmarks. And today I have to say that China may have done a great job in developing its economy and being part of the global trading system, but is China part of this global community that genuinely respects and embodies the values that we all find glorified, acceptable? The answer is perhaps not. And if we have that kind of answer, then we will have to say there's a third thing we can do that is refrain from telling its leaders what a great job they are doing, and they are now ought to be part of G8, part of this very respectable club.
I'm going to turn it over to you guys in a second and answer, ask you to solicit your questions. Professor Spence, before, I'd like to come back to you on this last point. I mean, the feeling a lot of us who don't know this area that deeply feel these days is the Chinese basically have us over a barrel, and there's not much we can do to influence them one way or another. And what I'm wondering is, would withholding our respect in a certain degree, as Dr. Pei describes, what effect would that actually have on the regime?
Well, I anguished as a non-diplomat about the difference between a state dinner and a state lunch for President Hu Jintao. And I'm not sure I've solved the dark and murky recesses there. Clearly, the Chinese would have loved a very formal state dinner, and they got a moderately chaotic lunch. I think what you're saying may be true, but it can also lead to a lot of petty slights, silly humiliations, which are quite unnecessary. I mean, surely there must be ways of peaceful visits for naval fleets to harbors. I remember many former examples, and or you can make that a confrontation every time it happened. You can have, as a layman to all these, once a junior compulsory soldier, I've always been intrigued by joint military maneuvers as a concept. It seems that that kind of thing may rather upgrade some other power, but it teaches you a lot about them. So these kinds of things, that is kind of interfering. It's a bit more like what Arthur said before. That book about to change China. When you start trying to do these changes, you're making ideological decisions all the time, and you're usually getting them wrong, it seems to be. So I'm not always a sort of laissez-faire, hands-off person. I am in this case. I would say that the contrary, give sort of the most polite treatment you feel is sensible. And yes, don't praise an actual sort of bloodstained dictator, but there are times we have to work with some pretty strange allies. And I would like to see China enmeshed in a whole lot of sort of middle-size exchanges and the kind of UNESCO-level kind of things, visiting military shared technology up to a certain level, which you people know about. I don't really understand that level. But keep as many ways open as possible, and also I think see when they have a dominant role to play, as I think would be, again we could argue a good bit about the Japanese approach, I think, I mean what exactly should be the best approach, but obviously with Korea, obviously with Vietnam, obviously with Myanmar, in all these cases China has strong interests and we should encourage them, I think, to build up those interests.
Yeah, on that point, the U.S. military has decided, evidently, that engagement with China is the way to go, at least temporarily. Last June, you had the biggest U.S. military exercise in Asia since the Vietnam War in Guam, and they invited a Chinese delegation not only to participate, but to give them access to our B-2 bombers, which are, you know, our biggest national strategic asset, super secret, in the air. Admiral Fallon, the combatant commander of Pacific Command, is repeatedly in China. He was recently in Harbin in Manchuria. The U.S. Navy is looking for combined naval exercises with China. Mm-hmm. So the Pacific Command position is, and Pacific Command is a different personality than Central Command. It's more naval, it's less army, mm-hmm. More area experts, because of marriage patterns and a whole bunch of things. And Pacific Command's attitude is really build up forces on U.S. territories, but engage the Chinese.
Using engage as a positive.
Yes. That's what I mean. Yes. Yeah. No. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Could I just say something on that? Yeah. I think Robert has done a very good job outlining a problem that we do have. And it really comes down to a very fundamental question about whether we have a human rights policy at all. Because as Americans, I think we like to imagine that somehow our diplomacy reflects our most deeply held values. And my view is that engagement is probably appropriate for China, although I think it should be cautious. I've known a number of these Pacific Fleet commanders, and they tend to be extraordinarily naive. And they send the message to the Chinese that we Americans are really rather simple-minded, which is absolutely not the message that we want to send.
But remember, is it true?
Well, I think it may be true, but remember that the Japanese strategy, their idea in 1941 was that after they sank our fleet at Pearl Harbor, we would then sue for peace talks, just as the Russians had after Admiral Togo sank Admiral Rozjestvenskiy's fleet at Tsushima. But I think on human rights, we are over a barrel. Because if engagement is right for China, then surely it's right for Iran, surely it's right for Korea. I mean, China may not be absolute zero as far as human rights goes, but it's down there. I mean, if you look at the Freedom House, if you look at the Freedom House evaluations, Iran scores higher in all categories than China does. Now, I'm not advocating that we should, say, aid North Korea or Iran, but I think there'd be no harm at all in having an American ambassador there who knows the language and who has a secure channel back to Washington. I think that what we're doing, for instance, in North Korea now, where the Chinese are the message carriers between Washington and North Korea, this is simply inviting manipulation. We have to have our own people there.
Question from you all. Please go ahead.
The question is there, in China's desire to grow their economy, is there an inherent contradiction between that and their ability to eventually keep control, given the integration and openness that growth could bring?
I think for a short time they can manage the tensions between the consequences of economic liberalization and modernization and the desire of maintaining one-party control. They've done that by investing in internet control capabilities, by maintaining a very large secret police, and by co-opting new social elites, professionals, the private entrepreneurs. They've been co-opting the party, given social and political respect. But over the long run, it's very hard to do, simply because the nature of authoritarian politics is excluding someone from sharing power. So there's a self-defeating logic. This is one. Second problem is that authoritarian politics has another characteristic that is called predatory. Because authoritarian politics, without exception, is incredibly corrupt. And the ruling elites in authoritarian regimes have very short time horizons. Because they go to bed tonight, they are not sure when they wake up tomorrow morning whether they're going to be in power. So that kind of uncertainty about the future. And in China today, you will find many officials are big believers in fortune telling. They would consult fortune tellers about their own political careers. And it tells you something about what they look, how they look at the future. So that combination of political insecurity and uncertainty about the future encourages predatory, corrupt behavior. So either there are two outcomes. One is that over long run economic growth continues and then creates such a dynamic society that political control under one-party rule cannot be maintained. Or somewhere along the way, corruption overwhelms the system and produces an outcome very similar to Indonesia. Indonesia, when you look at today's China and think about China 2050, think about Indonesia before 1997, the financial crisis. Because Indonesia did very well for 30 years. But at the end of the day, it was its corrupt politics that destroyed the economy. So there might be this gigantic detour in between.
I'd like to introduce something new?
Yeah.
I think another thing on this question of growing the economy, how, or I hate to say that word, it's not a verb, causing the economy to grow or making it grow. What about the environment? And this is something that people don't pay much attention to. If China is going to keep growing at the rate that she is growing, she's going to have to use 10 times as much water today as she used then, in 2050, as she uses today. Well, right now, China is short of water. Two of her major rivers scarcely flow. Groundwater levels are going down. Pollution levels are going up. And furthermore, compared to Japan, China uses 10 times as much water per unit of production. Likewise with energy. China uses 15 times as much energy per unit of value produced as Japan does. And large sections of China are just devastated ecologically. And my own view is that unless something is done about these externalities, the economic miracle is going to have problems. The Shanghai Daily reports that the cost of pollution is 10% of GNP. That means that if GNP grows at, say, 11%, and you subtract the environmental offset, maybe you have 1% growth. I think this factor has to be borne in mind. I actually believe it's more important than the military factor.
A point. In the 140th anniversary issue of the Atlantic Monthly in November 1997, the Atlantic published a long piece, not written by me, but by Mark Hertzgard, I believe, about the environment being China's number one national security problem over the long run. And he goes into depth on this. And even though it's almost a 10-year-old article, I recommend it. It's still very up to date.
From the back there. So.
My question also concerns trade, and specifically the U.S. or the Western approach to trade. I mean, obviously right now, you know, someone used the phrase over a barrel. It seems like our economy is remarkably reliant on China and its production capabilities. Is that a good thing moving forward for our relationship with China? Or is there something we should be thinking about to tip that balance?
You could also argue that if you owe someone a tremendous amount of money, that gives you a certain amount of leverage, too.
Yes. You could argue that.
I would not say the U.S. economy is overly dependent on China.
Right.
The two economies are closely interdependent. Then the question is, should this relationship break up, who will pay more? Today, I think the Chinese will still pay more.
Also, China is very much based on low-cost labor. And I think by 2050, there are going to be a lot of other low-cost labor countries, you know, Africa, Middle East, so forth.
Well, and wages are going up in China,
and
production is already moving to other areas.
I think that's
got a balancing factor. Just like the balance between entirely free independent companies and semi-government companies is opening up now more and more in ways we hadn't realized. And in the same piece I was looking at this morning, Geely, the car company,
yes,
automobile manufacturer, is moving into probably the number one spot in China. And its CEO was saying he's always stayed free of party or these easy get loans and this kind of thing. I don't think it's going to be too long before they're outsourcing various things much more to Vietnam. Or all kinds of things are going to change with the Indian economy and its relationship to China, I'd have thought. So I think that's self-adjusting. I'm sort of out of ignorance, maybe, but I'm optimistic about that.
And that may have political consequences over time as
yes,
well.
Yes, it's bound to, I think.
Well, their investment, it's interesting. An investment decision tells you sort of where you want to go. I mean, if you build shipyards, then you're obviously not going to go into agricultural processing. And one of the worrying things about China is how much investment has gone into export infrastructure, as opposed to the infrastructure for developing the country itself. Internal demand has been stagnant for a very, very long time. Most countries' rising internal demand drives growth. China has been relying on exports to drive growth. And this is, I think it's unsustainable in the long run.
Gentlemen, Richard Florida wrote two very interesting books in the last few years, The Rise of the Creative Class and The Flight of the Creative Class. And he talks about the advantages that individuals or corporations and nations will have comes from creativity, not from the service sector and not from the manufacturing sector. As you just mentioned, China's growth is dependent on low wages and, in essence, manufacturing. And they're doing it at a rapid rate for such a huge economy. Something has to give here. Does China's manufacturing hegemony begin to consume itself? And do you see China in 2050 contributing more, actually luring more of the creative class of the world to remove its own dependence on manufacturing as the staple of its economic growth?
Well, I can take a crack at that. I think that this business about creativity, if you look at, say, Soviet growth versus American growth, you'll find that Soviet growth was 4/5 capital accumulation and 1/5 productivity increase. United States was 1/5 capital accumulation and four-fifths creativity. Now take a country like Singapore, which by Chinese standards is rather free. Singapore has an enormously high emigration rate, enormously high. I have two brilliant Singaporean students at Penn. They're neither of them going back. They are precisely your creative class. And I think one of the problems that China has is that she wants to modernize her educational system. She wants people to be able to think. But of course, if you can think about physics at the cutting edge, how are you going to say, well, the three represents is the acme of political thought? That's just not how the human mind works. So unless they liberalize, unless they make the country congenial to the creative class, I think that they will then be dependent on copying.
You know, aren't we seeing, and it's all anecdotal, but aren't we seeing a lot of Chinese who are educated in the U.S. and work professionally in the U.S. now returning home to take participate in the gold rush?
Yeah, but they're not necessarily working for the government. Correct. They are typically working either for themselves, they're sitting for their own companies, or they're working for multinationals. I see these two pockets of excellence as having a lot of promise for the future. But if you want to work for the government, then you're going to waste your talent, waste your training.
That's because awesome.
The entire system can make you unlearn what you have learned in the U.S. very quickly.
Also, our visa system, we now have a class of visas that has Chinese come over here to study, and then they have to go back. We make them go back. It used to be said at the embassy in Beijing, we issue only one kind of visa. It's an immigrant visa. But that's no longer true. So some go back unwillingly. I have a Chinese doctor who's an acupuncturist. He's an absolutely brilliant man. Chinese educated, Oxford educated. And the first time that I lay down and he started sticking needles into me, I said, well, doctor, I predict, and he's done amazing things at Jefferson Hospital. He's gotten people off life support, respirators, all the rest using acupuncture. I said, I predict that the United States is now going to become the world center of research in Chinese medicine. And he said to me, you know, I came to that conclusion several years ago. And this was a man who tried very, very hard to find an appropriate environment in China, and he just couldn't find it.
And we'll have to close with the words of the Chinese acupuncturist, unfortunately.
I'm sorry.
We are out of time.
We could do worse.
We could do a lot worse. Thank our panelists very much. This is an extraordinary group. And thank you all for coming, and please stick around for what's next.